Hello, and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast. My name is Ben Miller. I'm CEO and co-founder of Fundrise. Today's episode is being recorded on November 16th, 2022. And I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for information and entertainment purposes only. We are trying something new today, a bonus episode, investor questions and answers with Kendall Davis, head of investor relations and investment operations. We get a lot of questions from investors, so we thought to make it its own standalone segment. So, hey, Kendall, let's get started.
Thanks for having me, Ben. I'm really excited about this segment. Lots going on in the world, and we are getting a ton of really interesting investor questions. So I'm excited to dig in.
All right, shoot.
So the first question is from Robert. He says, hi, as an investor, can you let me know what steps you guys have taken to mitigate losses during this coming downturn? Do you have free cash flow? Are the properties rented, sold, or more spec? If there's a severe downturn of 40% in new home prices, would Fundrise need to seek additional funding? It's a good question.
It's a great question. The economy is going to downturn. The stocks are down, bonds are down. So people are feeling a lot more worried. So let me answer that, but let me just go high level first, because this is like one of the most important things I've learned from going through now three or four crises or downturns. So the lesson is that the super context or the big macro context matters just as much, if not more, than the micro context, execution, what assets you own. So we definitely own great assets. And the most important thing to do is own good assets. If you own high quality assets versus low quality assets, there's a huge difference in performance, right? So that sounds so simple, right? But what happened in 2021 is we were at the peak of an economic cycle. When you're at a peak of the economic cycle, low quality assets perform the same, if not better, than high quality assets. So in capital markets talk, they call it the spread between high and low quality. So last year, the Fed created a risk on environment, right? Risk on means you take on risk. Interest rates were zero. So what that means is financial institutions could borrow money for free. And the Fed and Treasury basically printed and handed out trillions. I think it was $6 trillion. So the consequence of that was that the markets got warped. And what happened was the greater the risk, the greater the return. If you can borrow for nothing and they're printing money, the higher the risk asset, the higher the return will be. And so that's what attracted the most amount of money. And you look back and there was flying cars and crypto and space exploration. And so if you bought that risk back then, that's the asset you hold now. And the world has flipped to a risk off environment, right? The opposite is happening. Risk is being punished. And what happens in a downturn at the bottom of the market in particular is safety becomes overvalued and risk gets undervalued. We're basically in that situation now. So the big takeaway I learned in 2008 and in 2001 that you have to take the risk off the table before the downturn, before the financial crisis. Because by the time the downturn happens, it's too late. So how did we prepare over the last year or multiple years? Is we bought high quality assets, and those assets in particular were rental, residential, and the Sun Belt. And if you look at our performance like at the properties, occupancies 90-some percent, maybe occupancy in rental residential is as high as it's been like in history. We're still getting rent growth of approximately 5% a year. So rental residential really performs well in a downturn. And so if you go back to 2008, which was by far worse financial crisis, and real estate was the source of the financial crisis, especially housing. Housing fell from peak to trough 20%. And that was because there were so many bad loans made, very low quality borrowers, and you're just overbuilding. Right now we have high quality borrowers, much harder to get a loan, and either underbuilding or adequate building. That's how much housing prices fell last time. That's why I think housing prices are not going to fall nearly that much this time. But last time, rents only fell 4% in 2009. And then they rebounded in 2010. Housing prices fell five times as much in 2009 as rents. And it took housing prices 8 years to get back to where they were. And it took rental housing 1 year. So rental housing, especially in good markets, performs much better than for sale housing. And that doesn't even take into account that there are good cities with high growth, job growth, and cities that suffer more. So like Austin or Nashville or Charlotte are doing better than Buffalo or Dayton, Ohio. And so the national average of negative 4% masks the regional differences. That's a huge part of what's happening. And now if you go one level down below that, a typical real estate company, right, a typical private real estate player will borrow 65 to 75% when they buy real estate. The average leverage of our real estate is 43%, 45%, way lower leverage. The way you get wiped out is by leverage. Warren Buffett once said, quote, "My partner, Charlie Munger, says there's only three ways a smart person can go broke: liquor, ladies, and leverage." Now, the truth is, the first two he just added because they started with the letter L, because it's just leverage, end quote. So low leverage is absolutely critical. And then lastly, we have a lot of dry powder, because we were leaning back last year. And so across the platform, we have approximately $600 million of dry powder. So there is a downturn. I think we're well insulated from it, and no one's going to be completely immune. And on paper, right, let me actually mention one other thing. On paper, you know, in theory, the value of any asset is its future income streams. And so when the Fed raises interest rates from 0 to 5 or 10%, essentially what that means is that the value of that future income stream changes. It goes down. You're discounting it by a higher interest rate. So on paper, something may be worth less, especially right now when the Fed has raised interest rates at a soon-to-be peak level. So they're trying to crush inflation quickly. So during that sort of 6 months or year where they are trying to hike interest rates to peak, that is going to cause paper losses for some people. And also a very good time to buy real estate or any other assets, because on paper, they're being discounted. And I do think inflation is coming down. Everybody's seeing that now. So there's sort of a moment when you want to actually flip and start taking on risk. You want to take on risk right now, because risk is now being mispriced. Last year, it was mispriced and it was too cheap. And now risk is being mispriced and it's too expensive, right? If you go take on risk, you're going to get over-rewarded for it. And so that's what's happening right now in the market. And that's why we're getting so optimistic. We have good defense. We're moving to offense. And we're going to go out and deploy into this environment.
I think that last point is a really important one, Ben. I think that's something that a lot of our investors would probably be learning for the first time to hear that.
Yeah, everybody actually who becomes an investor reads about Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett always says, you know, you need to be greedy when people are afraid and afraid when people are greedy. So everybody knows that. But then when you're in the actual downturn, in the crisis, so much harder to behave that way. I'm saying we're in that now, and it's time to move from defense to offense.
Yeah, emotions come into play, right? It's like the quote with ladies and liquor.
Yeah.
Let's dive into the next one. So this next question comes from Matt. He says, "I'm more familiar with your performance over the last 5 years in your growth metrics. Can you share stats on how the platform did prior to 2017, considering those 5 years were a major boom in housing prices? How are you positioned to give consistent returns when prices begin to slide?"
Okay, there's two questions here. The first one's a fun one, because Fundrise has been in business since 2012, 10 years ago, and people don't realize how much real estate's changed in that time. You know, that was coming out of the great financial crisis. I previously had been a real estate sponsor with $500 million of real estate that I had to manage through the great financial crisis in 2008 and 9 and 10, and then started Fundrise. And we invested in a totally different investment strategy back then. In 2012, the investment strategy was to invest in emerging neighborhoods. The millennial or echo boom was graduating from college. It was the biggest generation in history. Something like a couple million more people were graduating a year in that period than now. And they were all moving to cities, and they were all renting apartments and going to cafes and going to restaurants. And it just caused this huge boom in these parts of the city that had previously been run down. And so in New York, that's Williamsburg and Bushwick and In LA, that's LA Arts District. In DC, that's H Street. So it was happening everywhere. And we were investing in that across the country. We did maybe 100 investments around that strategy. And then we pivoted in 2016, 17 towards rental housing in the Sun Belt. And we started to exit the emerging cities. We said, I think this is getting overpriced and over extrapolated. And so we had good performance back then. The yields you could get on mezzanine debt back then were 12, 14, 16%. And what's funny is that went away from 2017 to 2021. And now that's come back. Those yields, you remember, Kendall.
I know. I joined in 2014. And I remember that was one of my first sort of entrees into Fundrise was we had a couple of pref deals. And we talked about how coming out of the financial crisis, there was this gap in the capital stack, right? Because all of the banks were suddenly becoming so much more regulated and there was an opportunity. And I think you talked about this a little bit in the last podcast, but it's so interesting how, I mean, that those were really attractive yields. And then too many people rushed into that space, right? And so it's interesting that we are seeing that what goes around comes around.
Yeah, it's funny getting older, you can sort of see it like happen repeating in your own life. So in the last episode, I talked about how the banks got regulated, they pulled back on their lending, created a gap. We were funding into that gap. And then over time, what happened was a lot of non-bank financial institutions started funding into that gap. And the gap got mispriced. By 2021, it was too expensive. It was like overfunded. And we basically had stopped funding into it more or less. And that's probably the part of the market that gets punished the most in the next 2 years. So we were in it, we got out of it, and we're going to go back into it. All right. Let's do one more.
Okay. All right, great. This one's from Joshua. Does Fundrise have third-party audits and reviews done of its balance sheet and forward-looking strategy? Is this made available to investors?
Yeah, this is such a good question. So I'll give you some of it. I'll tell you some of my experience because it's actually fascinating being so heavily regulated. So, okay, our funds are publicly reporting to the SEC, like the Securities and Exchange Commission. We file audited financial statements with the SEC like public companies do. And to be a public company or publicly reporting company, you have to be audited. Most of our funds are audited by KPMG. So they're one of the big four accounting firms. And we also have to file all sorts of other things with the SEC. Like you have to file annual and semi-annual financials with strategy and management comp. And if management is buying or selling any of the securities, we're also a registered investment advisor. And then the last thing, last year we hired this CFO named Allison Stallo. So Allison joined us like April of last year. And she was an auditor at KPMG. And then she joined the SEC and became the chief accountant at the SEC Division of Investment Management. And so why did the former chief accountant of the SEC join Fundrise as our chief financial officer? Why did she join the company? Because she got offers from other really big companies because she really got excited about the mission. Like she thought, oh, wait a second. The mission of Fundrise is to build a better financial system for individuals, not just for institutions. Most of the financial sector is focused on institutional investors, not individual, especially the private market. So that gives somebody a good sense of what's going on behind the curtain, the kind of oversight and regulations and safeguards or checks that exist. But it's funny, like I have a lot of venture funds I've talked to over the years and a lot of like people from sort of Silicon Valley mindset. And they always say to me, how did you guys do this? How did you get around the regulations? Like, literally their words. And I always say, no, we didn't get around them. We went through the front door. And that's not the mentality of most tech companies. Most tech companies is you go out, you break the rules, and you get big enough that you can potentially fix it later. I mean, Uber did it and did it successfully. And that's not what we did. But anyways, it's something that takes a huge amount of time and energy from our team. It's critical, but it's one of those things that, like a lot of good things in tech, it's invisible because basically it works. And when it doesn't work, then it's very visible.
Yeah, this is sort of a corny analogy, but, you know, I've got three kids and we read Going on a Bear Hunt. They say you can't go around it. You've got to go through it. And
oh, I love that book.
It's such a great book. I always think about this because I think, you know, you want regulations to work to your advantage and you need to work with them. And I think about that in everything from what we were just talking about with taking advantage of sort of the gap financing to how can we leverage the evolution of regulation to further our mission and our purpose. And I think you in particular are someone who's really embodied that over the years.
Oh, no compliments here, Kendall. We don't have time. But yeah, actually, like, so I'm going to go a little bit further into our history. So back in 2011, when we sort of conceived of this idea, I went to like 12 different law firms and like, how do you do this? How do you do this? And then no one knew. And I was in DC at the time. I happened to talk to a friend of mine complaining about how I couldn't figure out how to basically to democratize investing in real estate on the internet. I was complaining about it to my friend and she said, my cousin just retired from the SEC. He was director of internet enforcement. So I was like, oh my God, I meet him. I went and met him and I was like, here's what I want to do. I want to democratize investing in real estate on the internet. How do I do it? He said to me, I have no idea. I work in enforcement. You need to talk to Marty Dunn. He's the guru. He's like the guru. He's the guy who knows how to do this. There's always a guy, right? There's always a guy. And so I got meetings with him. We had lunch. He just left the SEC. He was general counsel of the SEC. He was acting director of CorpFin. And he just literally been in there so long, decades. He wrote most of these regs that we're talking about. And he was such a prince. And I told him I wanted to do. He's like, oh, that sounds so fun. That sounds so fun. Let's try to do this. And it took us a year. I went into the SEC, met with them, and it took us a year to figure out how to do this. He passed on last year. We wouldn't have been able to do this without him. Anyway, so that's like kind of origin story of how we sort of figured out how to democratize investing in real estate like you can for stocks and bonds. Like, why shouldn't people be able to do that the way that institutions do? Didn't make sense to me, and we did it. We did it. I mean, it's been 10 years to do it, but it's been worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. Marty Dunn was such a complete legend and just a really great guy all around. I remember him well.
Yeah, he was so warm. It's just like, anyways.
Well, one other thing that I thought, a lot of people think that because we are a private company or that our funds are private, that means that we don't have all of these regulations. And I do think it's really important to emphasize that these are effectively public standards that we're being held to in terms of all of the different filings and requirements. And do think that those who are not in the space may not have a full appreciation for that.
That's how what we worked out with the SEC over a decade. We figured out basically, well, essentially hold yourselves to a public company standard because the public's going to invest in it. And that's the big innovation, to do all this work.
Our accounting team loves us for it.
Actually, I thought you were going to say in one other thing. So the company Fundrise itself, the parent, is actually also publicly reporting and also audited and also regulated. And so it's not just our funds, also the company. And so if you want to know about our company, you can go on EDGAR, which is where all public companies file their financials and you can see it. So we have like a lot of transparency. Hopefully I addressed the question. It's the right question. I mean, being skeptical, I'm a skeptic. So I appreciate when someone's skeptical of anybody, including me.
I think especially in this environment, it's in every investor's best interest to be skeptical about everything. And there's a lot of hype that gets thrown in the mix and being skeptical usually pays off in the long run. So it's these sort of sexy companies that get overvalued and then suddenly people get burned. That's a good one to end off on, Ben. As always, thank you so much for answering these questions. For those of you listening, please keep the questions coming. Send us an email at contact@fundrise.com. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. So if you have any feedback on this episode, we'd love to hear it. Send us an email once again at contact@fundrise.com. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thanks, Kendall. You're the best. All right, so you've been listening to a bonus episode, Onward, the Fundrise podcast, featuring Kendall Davis, Head of Investor Relations and Investor Operations, and me, Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to follow us whenever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. This podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did our music. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.